This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. How are the doctors doing this evening?
Good.
Very well. How are you, Nate?
I'm doing fantastic. All right, so we are approaching the end of the first month of January, or the first month of 2020, and a lot of good feedback from the last episodes with regards to New Year's resolutions, people trying to escape the pleasure trap, trying to reframe the process-oriented goals that Dr. Hawk talked about a couple episodes ago. So today's show, we're talking about the first question is all actually about doing things in terms of moderation versus fanaticism in terms of life pursuits. And then we're going to talk a little bit about social media, or maybe a lot about social media as a potential pleasure trap. We'll talk about depression. And then we've got a question from a man who is curious as to why his girlfriends, when they get mad at him, they just shut down and ignore him. So we're looking forward to talking. And then we've got a caller on hold already. This is Mike from Florida. So Mike, hang on and we will get to you in just a bit. But let's just get right down to it. What do you guys say?
Cool. Sounds good.
Sure. Yeah, sounds
perfect.
Good.
All right. Dear doctors, my brother never does anything in moderation. For example, if he starts working out, he'll organize his entire life around it. He'll stop all social drinking and everything else. Now, then he will eventually feel empty and complain that he's burnt out. Now, it was a combination of university and an internship consuming all of his time. He complained about no longer having a social life and generally made depressing noises. Then one day, hungover, he informed me that he was drinking again. I can't tell if he stepped back towards the ego trap or he's just negotiated some relaxation with himself. My question is he destined to live in this open, unstable roller coaster ride? Or can I give him some advice, like Harry Brown style advice, that might help him find his place?
Well, it's not likely that we're going to give much advice that's going to be very helpful. That's a rare event in human affairs.
Despite the fact that we have a podcast.
So certainly I don't know how young or old this person is. It sounds like he's in his 20s probably or so, relatively a young person. And so it sounds like he's got a lot of push. So there's a lot of conscientiousness and some openness. And those two things are driving him into going all out, in a pursuit and then burning out on it and then going to the next thing. So this is part of what we're going to call genetic niche picking. It's a, you can think of an animal's behavioral program that there would be a certain percentage of its life energy and its lifespan that it should utilize in order to take a survey of its domain. So that's why openness is a experimentation and risk-taking there is useful. So think of a cockroach that's in an area where there's a bunch of quite a few predators. God knows, I don't know what would be, maybe they're my cats. Cockroaches are in my house. So just think about, and that cockroach is trying to figure out what the best place is to live. And it could be the case that 30 yards away, things will get a lot better. Gets to the other side of a fence, no cats, and suddenly life gets a lot, essentially a lot safer. So you can imagine that this would always be the potential case if you're a dung fly or you're a chimpanzee or a human or a bird or anything else under the sun, that right on the other side of some barrier or just some unit amount of effort, the situation could improve dramatically. So the way we get, so nature would have to embed in organisms a cost-benefit analytic process by which we would try to figure out whether or not it is worth continuing to explore. And you can actually see how people could wind up wasting a lot of energy, for example, if they get very lucky early in life, and then they maybe get a little bit lucky a little bit later, then they might spend their whole lives chasing an unrealistic dream, like, for example, being a big fancy actor. So maybe they, as a child actor, they get a part and it happens to be a hit. And so now they think, you know, now they spend the next 20 years chasing Hollywood around, trying to, you know, have this big thing happen because it looked like it was going to happen based on very early good feedback. So you can see that very early good feedback isn't necessarily a good thing, but what the organism is attempting to do is take into account what happens as it puts out energy and tries to explore its domain, the adaptive domain, and then see what the feedback looks like. So this is precisely what goes on in dating. It goes on in job hunting. It goes on in niche picking for careers. It goes on in deciding where it is that you're going to live. It goes on in everything. And so the idea here is that, you know, this guy's probably, from the sound of it, like I said, relatively young. And he's pretty open. And he's pretty conscientious. So he has a lot of push and he'll throw himself into things. What he's doing is he's niche picking. He's attempting to find a really good spot within the adaptive domains that are available to him. That's fine. And we hope that he doesn't drown in a pleasure trap. Pleasure traps being a particularly vicious potential trap for individuals that are open. They're more likely to try dangerous things. They're more likely to try addictive things, and they're more likely to be trapped by those things just by virtue of their openness. So that's a bizarre modern penalty to the openness chip in the modern environment that was never there before. So there was no such price to openness 10,000 years ago. So so he lives with some susceptibility, sounds like. So that's a bit of a problem. There's not too much we can do to talk open people out of that. Their openness is pretty defiant and pretty obstinate, you know, at whatever genetic level it's set. And so all government attempts to try to get people to not drink or not use drugs, I mean, finally they've given up. look what's happened in the last 5 years. Like when I was a kid, marijuana, you know, that was like a terrifying word. That would like drive you crazy and you'd lose your mind. And, you know, that's what I learned when I was 6 years old, you know, in the 1966.
Yeah.
So now it's
reefer
like
madness.
It's legal. You've got CBD ads all over the freeways. And, you know, finally, they just went belly up and said, okay, we're just going to tax it. So the reason is you're not going to stop open people. You can do so at great expense with great tragedy. If you try to do that, you create black markets, Al Capone, and every gangster crossing borders with drugs, et cetera, and non-enforceable contracts, et cetera. So finally, they just throw up their hands and say, "All right, forget it. You know, we're no longer going to police this, and we're just going to make it an open commodity." Fine, good. A lot of lives will be saved there, but a lot of open people will get little hooks in their mouths. So it'll be a problem. But they were going to probably do that anyway. So your brother's got some openness. He's got some push. He doesn't just sit idly by and let life float past him. He jumps in with both feet. Then he gets burned out because it turns out that the open person often jumps into things and then finds out that their extraordinary optimism or somewhat distorted optimism over the CB of that endeavor turns out to be not worth it. That's what openness is. By definition, openness is optimistic. It's a, by definition, being more open than the average is having a distorted view of the value of exploration, that the new domains are going to be better than the existing domains. It's inherently optimistic. And so what happens to people that are inherently optimistic? They get disappointed. That's what's going to happen, okay? We thought it was going to be this great thing. It turns out it's not. Oh well. And so this sort of, so asking the question, is he destined to have instability in this life? The answer is probably yes. Behind the openness is, it sounds like he doesn't have super stable personality riding shotgun for his openness. So as a result of that, you know, open people are going to be, all things being equal, they're going to be more inherently volatile. They're going to get more excited about things. Then they're going to wind up with some disappointments because they're going to take risks that appear to be like they're going to pan out, but then they won't. That's just the way it goes. Open people are very, very typically entrepreneurial in some fashion in those domains. They're also far more likely, for example, to get divorces because they believe that they can get a better situation than the one that they're suffering in. They're more likely to change jobs. What's that?
Relax, Horace.
The kind of advice, you know, that if you're a brother, I mean, the person mentions, you know, Harry Brown type of advice. I think Harry Brown himself is maybe one of the best things you could do is you buy him a copy of How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. And that's, you know, he's probably might be open enough to read it. And in that, he might glean and organize some good decision-making strategies that would serve him well. That's one highly open, very beautiful philosopher speaking to a young person that sounds like he's got a lot of chops, but has a personality that could, you know, wind him up into various troubles and also wind him up into various frustrations. So How I Found Freedom in a Free World is a quiet a way of sort of getting across many of the points that we make here, which is that it's about discovering your own identity and then also respecting the fact that other people's identities won't change. And so those two insights are really key insights. We, instead of calling it identity, we call it personality. So discovering your own personality, you may think why would you want to do that? Well, it's about you discovering what in the world you find interesting and what seems worthwhile for you to be doing. And then the second part of that, that's the quote, learning yourself or knowing yourself. But the second part of that is another insight that comes alongside is super important. And that is that you're not going to change and neither is anybody else. So the dynamics between two individuals are going to be remarkably stable over their lifespans because the personalities are set. And so a lot of life is about discovering not only what general opportunities are fit well for your personality, but also finding additional aspects of your ecology that would be ideal for you, including your social ecology, i.e. who are the people. And so, respecting the fact that we're not going to fix relationships, we're going to find them. Okay, you don't create a love dynamic, you discover it. And so, of course, you know, these relationships take time in order for you to make assessments of who those people are and whether or not there are mutual interests. But otherwise, you're not going to change the dynamics. And so these lessons, you know, a thing like How I Found Freedom in a Free World might be one of the better things that a brother could give a brother or, a friend could give a friend as an encapsulation of some very good advice that you don't have to give him. You could just give him a very entertaining, thoughtful, humorous, and deep book on the subject that I think encapsulates a lot of great lessons.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. I resonate with this question a lot just because of the high openness. And, you know, one thing that I really enjoy from this podcast is you basically said is, you know, enjoy your time on this planet and enjoy all the, you know, all the open things an open person are going to want to get into, but just don't get anyone pregnant. Don't get pregnant yourself and don't do the hard drugs.
Yeah.
That's really, you know, everything else, just enjoy.
Everything else is play. You got it. Yeah.
Yeah, as a fellow super open person, I'll just chime in there and say also, like, I know that in my wayward, crazy, open youth, I frustrated a lot of people in my life, like this guy's frustrated with his brother. Like, you know, people who were less open and close to very open people have this kind of, like, are you ever going to get your act together feeling about super open people? And I definitely was on the other end of that a lot. And, you know, as Dr. Lyle's saying, there's a lot of the openness is driving that optimism and the adventurousness, and you're just fully diving into whatever opportunity is in front of you at any given time. And the threshold is just so much higher for how much data you need. An open person is not satisfied. They don't close down the CB on any opportunity until they just get more information than other people would need. So that's part of what's going on too. But the good news is that as an open person becomes older and wiser and has more experiences and develops more correlations, if they have any IQ in there as well, they do get wiser about the choices they're making because they're better able to detect, oh, this open crazy opportunity resembles another crazy open opportunity that I had in the past, and I've already kind of done that one, and I can anticipate that there's going to be a similar result in the following ways, and so my CB is not going to lead me back down that yellow brick road quite the way that it did before. So you will generally watch people they look like they become less open with time. They're not becoming less open. They're just getting smarter about which opportunities they're jumping fully into and what kind of data they need before they can run a accurate CB on it.
That's fascinating, Dr. Hawk. Yeah. Beautiful. And not to mention the crazy wild stories from the older open people. I mean, I've met a few in my life, and it's really fun to hear all of the things that they learned lessons from.
Sure. Yeah, we have a lot more fun in our youth. We definitely collect some stories.
All right. Well, the next question is, dear doctors, I've heard Dr. Hawk talk about social media as a potential pleasure trap. And I was wondering if she could go into more depth on that. What are the circuits being hijacked? And what advice would you give to a low-key social media addict?
Yeah, I complain about the various traps associated with social media all the time, in part because I've found myself trapped by them myself. So this is, you know, ripped from the headlines of my own life. I'm in that sort of bridge generation where I'm old enough to remember what it was like before all of this existed, but I'm also completely dependent on it and enmeshed in it and have definitely been trapped by social media in all the ways that people are. I think there are two major issues with social media and the social media trap, and one is the distraction of it. So people are not able to, you know, concentrate as deeply as they might like to, or they're constantly finding their attention, being grabbed by their phone and by their notifications, and you're swiping through things all the time, and they're going from app to app, and so they're losing that ability for sustained concentration, which I think people are aware of, and they're distracted on their phone when they want, you know, might otherwise want to be engaged deeply in some kind of conversation with somebody, all that kind of distraction stuff. But then the other thing that I have talked about a lot, and the thing that I think is riskier and more detrimental for people, is the nature of the pseudo-esteem trap that is associated with social media, and the ways in which social media is hijacking all of our really beautifully evolved attunement to social cues and really exaggerating those cues and leading us down avenues that are really bad news for us. So I think you address both of these things in different ways. So the distraction piece, I think you have to just white knuckle your way out of that addiction like any other addiction and prepare for the fact that it's going to be uncomfortable and that you're going to recalibrate to it. So I think a lot of people can't really do social media in moderation. They try to, but it doesn't really work. Some people can do that. Some nervous systems can manage that. But a lot of people just have to outright delete the apps. At one point I read that the Facebook engineer who developed the like button for Facebook had to delete Facebook from his phone. He deleted Facebook from his phone, and he deleted all his other apps from his phone, and then he installed parental controls on his phone so he couldn't re-download the apps. Like, these are the lengths that you have to go to if you're finding yourself just absolutely distracted and constantly going back and constantly scrolling. The other thing that I realized at some point is that these apps, including Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, all of them, they are very actively, consciously mimicking slot machines in a lot of different ways, down to the pull and scroll routine. When you're pulling it, it's literally like a slot machine where you don't know what's going to pop up. So you pull the screen, and the data is showing that we swipe our screens on our phones on the order of 3,000 times a day. It's how often we're on average swiping these things. So we're just scrolling, and it's like, oh, it might be an ad, or it might be a picture of a cute puppy, or it might be some, you know, it might be a dating app, and it might be someone you could go out with. It's like incredibly reinforcing. So these guys who engineered these things know this. The flag on the Facebook notification alert is red for a reason. It's red because it's an alert. It's getting your attention. It's danger. It's like your eye is drawn to that little flag on that notification button, very deliberately. So we are being actively pulled into this process. So it's not like some kind of personal failing that you've become addicted to your apps. This is by design. So I have deleted most things from my phone. I usually will lapse and reinstall them, and then I'll delete them again. I try to basically only let my attention get sucked in by Instagram these days, because Instagram is like the least fraught with all of the pseudo-esteem stuff that I'll talk about in a second. It's mostly just like pictures of dogs and food, and there's less kind of status associated with it. Twitter, Facebook, some of the others where you're carving out a position in the community that's associated with your self-presentation, that's a slightly different deal. So either deleting the apps, there are fun apps that I got to manage my productivity on both the computer and the phone, especially when I was finishing my dissertation, that made concentration more possible. Like, I never could have finished my dissertation without a application called Self Control, which allows you to whitelist certain websites and it blocks the rest of the internet to you for a certain amount of time. Even if you try to restart your computer, you are not able to do anything other than go on the specific sites that you whitelist. So that was very helpful. The phone has a great little app that you can get called Forest, which you set a little timer on Forest and it starts to plant trees for you. And if you interrupt it to go look at Facebook or go look at Twitter, you kill the trees.
I have a barren, all the barren trees landscape die, on my forest.
And the app gets very... It's, yeah. So these are like little tricks that you can use to keep yourself out of just idly scrolling on the phone and giving away all of that time and attention in a way that you wouldn't necessarily want to be doing. And, you know, there are people who have just completely ditched the smartphone, gone back to the old school phones, cut off their internet service. People can go to all kinds of lengths to maintain their attention, especially if they're trying to finish some sort of big project that requires sustained attention. So all kinds of different points on the spectrum that people can do. But the pseudo esteem is the real problem. So it's like you got to realize that you are an animal that has this is exquisitely evolved hypersensitivity to the most subtle of social cues to let you know how you're doing in the village at any given time. Like, that is what humans are. It's you were looking for somebody to slightly roll their eyes when you say something, or to give you a slight cold shoulder in the village square, and you're integrating all of that information and using it to estimate how you're doing and what people are thinking of you and what that means for your place in all of these competitive domains. And so social media has taken that sensitivity and this highly evolved ability, and it has just absolutely blown it super out of proportion and hyper exaggerated it with likes and retweets and who is valuing you for what you're saying in this sort of artificial public square. And the idea that you would you would have some kind of awareness in a Stone Age village of all these people talking about you and just not care and not and be able to tune it out and not engage with it and not have it bother you. Of course you would care. Of course you would be wondering what they were saying. Of course you would be just hyper attuned to it. So these are the pathways that are getting absolutely intruded upon by social media in this quasi-anonymous space. And people are really susceptible to it for really absolutely predictable and natural reasons. So I think there's also the phenomenon that happens where when you make a public declaration, like you, for instance, you, even if you post a tweet that expresses some kind of opinion on Twitter, you're essentially, what you're doing is you are increasing the cost of reversal on that opinion. So you're digging yourself into this public statement that is now linked to all of the status in the community of you are associated with this opinion, and the cost of reversing it, even in the face of evidence, becomes much, much higher. So things just get more polarized. Debate declines in quality, and it's just a total mess. So there's so many terrible things about social media. People would do really well to be aware of all this. I understand absolutely how addictive it is, and how difficult it is to pull yourself out of these traps. But it's important to be aware of what's going on. And then, of course, meanwhile, they're harvesting all this personal data about you and marketing to you, and it's being used against you to sell you your worst fears and to mobilize you in political campaigns. So, just delete the apps, really, at the end of the day.
That's brilliant. I love that.
Wow. Spectacular.
Yeah, I could rant at length, but Doug probably wants to jump in there with other stuff too.
Truth is, I know very little about it because I'm not on these things. I got exactly one interaction on Facebook about 7 years ago. Seven or 8 years ago, I found out about this thing, Facebook. And so then I contacted an old basketball friend of Alan's and mine, Jim Souders. And like a week or so later, he got back to me. He says, "Oh, what are you doing up in Sacramento?" And that was it. I didn't know how to write back to him. So that's the sum total of my Facebook career. And
that's good. And keep it that's, that way.
In terms of, I can see the value, obviously, in posting things and announcements of, for people that are close to you for communication purposes or for business commercial purposes. What I have seen is I've seen a lot of hurt feelings. I've had a lot of clients that were that had bad things went badly between them and other people on Facebook, and or whatever. I mean, Facebook's the only one that I really am in touch with at all, that people talk to me about. So, I mean, is it an evil thing? No, it's not an evil thing, but it is like the pleasure trap, in the sense that, a glass of wine now and then might really add value to people's lives. But if you're susceptible and it traps you, and then it can be a mess. And the same thing with food. This with the pleasure trap is the story of supernormal stimuli, and of any kind, including gambling, as Jen was talking about. So, gambling, food, drugs, and now we have a new one, which is essentially it's esteem. So it's the esteem processes of humans. Are now subject to supernormal stimuli, and oops, we can expect quite a bit of mess and some excitement. Just like, hey, listen, a piece of chocolate cake, vegan chocolate cake, that's a supernormal stimuli, and I'm glad it exists. And no matter what Alan says, I'm gonna get mine. Okay, so. It's not like supernormal stimuli is inherently evil or bad. It's just, it always winds up being a two-edged sword. And so it's, we got to be careful of the sharp edge.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, is like, especially when you're you're sort of living your life in a very, like, talk about niche picking, you know, in the evolutionary psychology world, it's very hard to find like-minded people out there without some social media involved. So it's like, how else are you going to find fellow travelers who are interested in the same kinds of things? Well, this is where Twitter hashtags are incredibly useful, and finding different little communities. But you are really playing with fire, because in this quasi-anonymous public square, this is not a situation that you would have had in the Stone Age, where people were, you know, trolls are running the show to such a degree in this anonymous way, and having such a disproportionate effect on the hyper agreeable, the hyper conscientious, the slightly less emotionally stable. Like, if you have any one or all three of those characteristics, you're going to be so much more susceptible to criticism online and have such a harder time dealing with trolls and letting them sort of bounce off of you. My hyper agreeableness makes it really, really difficult thing for me to deal with criticism online, and to the point where I'm not even in the Beat Your Jeans has a Facebook fan group that a lot of listeners are members of, which has, you know, a bell curve distribution of agreeableness in it, and there are people in that group who are pretty disagreeable and talk some shit, and it's very, very hard for me to watch that happening. Just like if it were happening in the village square, I would have a hard time, but at least I would be able to defend my honor in the village square in a more legitimate kind of way, and people would not be able to hide behind quasi-anonymity. They'd have to tell me things to my face. There would be a more kind of legitimate process of all of that stuff.
And without
being invented,
sucking
where
up hours
it all
of your
just
day.
Gets exaggerated. And it's sucking up hours of your day where you're looking for cues. You're looking for, you know, any sort of, you know, are they talking about you? Are they, what's going on? What's my status? What's my esteem? Where am I in the hierarchy? Which are all the things that we're doing all the time. That's what human life is. That's all you're doing. And so here it's this incredibly exaggerated version of that, where the highs are higher, where you feel very, you know, you get praise and you feel secure and you feel like this is a super normal hit of belonging and value. But then at the same time, if you've got some kind of vulnerability where people are criticizing you, that immediately becomes much more relevant for your potential survival and reproductive, your genetic survival in general. Because if you can't identify the exact nature of that threat and how significant it is and how much it's going to infect other people's opinion of you, it's again not a Stone Age situation that you would have a whole kind of separate identity that other people had created to describe who it is that you were that wasn't linked to your actual interaction with you. There wasn't this kind of pseudo esteem the way that there is now, and it's very tricky, and it absolutely hijacks these highly evolved abilities and requirements that we attune to other people's social cues, and it's a disaster for happiness for a lot of people.
Now, Dr. Lyle, you've said before, you've talked about the fractured village and how this creates stress because people are essentially trying to become the most valuable coalition members of every group that they're in.
Right.
And so this adds essentially an infinite number of people in an infinite number of villages.
Oh yeah. And this is, you know, this is a conversation I've had with a bunch of people and a bunch of very accomplished people, that will talk to me in, you know, some of our listeners, know me through the hyper health arena and some of them don't. But in the hyper health arena, I know a lot of the movers and shakers, listen how important I am. Jesus. It's just so
name dropping.
Let me start name dropping, okay? But the thing is that I know that in this last decade they've had times that when they were upset about criticism. And these are marvelous people. I could name several examples, but it's their private affair, but one was very public, which was Colin Campbell was being just raked completely unfairly, and like an unbelievable human being that Colin Campbell is, he painstakingly, carefully educated the critic. It was it's like only Colin Campbell.
So heartbreaking.
Only Colin would have done something like that. I wouldn't have. I would have responded with a McDougal like vitriol. That's how I am. I'm not the great professor. okay? And
it's your toxic masculinity privilege talking right there.
And you know, I've had many of my friends.
You don't have that same agreeableness.
Yeah, many of my friends have been bruised up. Fabulous people that do great things, and then again, a little sand ruins a great cake. You know, it doesn't matter if you're Chef AJ making that cake. Somebody could try to throw some sand in it. And you're out there just trying to do great things for people, and you know, or Colin or Essie or McDougal or Alan. Alan doesn't care about credit.
Yeah, 0% agreeable.
Alan doesn't care. So you guys, anybody out there that wants to criticize Dr. Alan Goldhammer, trust me, it won't hurt his feelings. It's not worth the trouble. But the rest of us are like real, less of us are legitimate people.
Yeah, when I was an intern at True North for the first time, there was a staff suggestions and a patient questionnaire that Dr. Goldhammer would have a little box where you can drop off the evaluations of the center and you know, anything like that. And where was this box located? In the oven. Talk about a signal being sent.
Oh, I just cursed and I remembered. I'm gonna be with Chef AJ at her birthday celebration in Florida in March. Yeah, so I don't know if anybody wants to join us. I don't know how you find out about it, but you can go to her website. It's gonna be great fun. All right, let's go on to something else.
All right, so something else is we have two callers on hold right now.
Oh,
so
wow.
Our first caller. So we're going to try to get to both of them. Our first caller is Mike from Florida. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Can you guys hear me?
Hi, Mike.
Good.
Yeah, we can hear you.
All right. I just had one question for you guys. I was listening, and a couple of shows back, you talked about single mothers and the outcomes of the children of single mothers aren't as good as an intact family, and you guys talked about how, you know, the general consensus is it's the parenting, but you guys just said it's the genes showing up in that child, and that it's conscientiousness and IQ, and you kind of went on without going over it too much. I had a couple of questions because I mean, conscientiousness, that makes sense, but I know in the 1950s, the out-of-wedlock birth rate was like 2%. And now it's like 50%. And back then, abortion was illegal. Birth control was illegal, even for married people sometimes. And I know a lot of those kids got adopted out or were raised by the grandmother, and they pretended it was a pregnancy late in the grandmother's life. But I suppose that would take into consideration those situations as well, although there was shotgun marriages, I suppose, to kind of counteract that. And my question is, like, is it just that the CB shifted so much where that in the 50s they were like, okay, if you have a kid out of wedlock, if you're not conscientious, you're just going to starve to death. So it was like that. It was that serious that people just – the CB shifted that much that people didn't have kids out of wedlock. And also the question I had about IQ was I understand conscientiousness affecting that, but IQ – were you guys just saying that people with lower IQ might not understand that the government can come in, might not understand the extent of the that the government can come after them, the men, for example, for resources? And that's kind of linked to if you have two parents, you can have more resources, and the data seems to show more resources causes better outcomes, which makes sense. So I was just wondering if that had something to do with it too. Because if you have two parents, you have more resources for the child as opposed to one, and some help from the government or child support or whatever. So that's all. That's, you know, I just found that fascinating. It makes sense from that standpoint. But I was just really interested in what you guys had to say about that, as opposed to the standard explanation that it's the parenting. It's the genes expressing themselves instead. That's all.
Jen, You want to go or?
Yeah. I mean, it's. I remember this from a couple of weeks ago, and I think you were talking a lot about this. I mean, it's generally this is a correlation causation difference, you know, that we talked about before. So there's you know, you're seeing a lot of outcomes that are traveling through the same genes that are traveling through the family, and the environment is like an artifact of those genes. So kids are growing up in chaotic environments that are being sort of, the environment is being created by chaotic genes, essentially. So it's not that the environment is not causally creating who this person is becoming. They're becoming the person that they are in some sense hardwired to become, regardless of the environment, because of a genetic predisposition, whether it's a level of conscientiousness or predisposition to alcohol or predisposition to divorce or anything else. All of these things are, this is why we talk about Blueprint so often, the book by Robert Plowman, which is tracking these changes throughout the course of the life. So I remember, though, that you got into a lot more detail when you were answering this question beyond just the sort of correlation causation confusion.
Yes. So Mike raises a number of issues or observations and questions. And so one of them is, you go from 2% out of wedlock to some huge number now. Mike, you're correct. It's about the cost-benefit analysis. So it's hard for us to imagine in 2020 just how poor people were in 1950. They were unbelievably poor. Okay, so what we would now consider just a horrendous, low rent, disastrous tenement would have been good, solid middle class or above in 1950. So we can't imagine what a tremendous threat it was to a woman to be a single mom and to not have support. That was very bad news. I believe if we looked at the data, I think I looked at one point, maybe in 1968 or so, about 50% of the United States was earning the minimum wage. So I think I've said this before. The lady across the street from me in my middle-class house with my middle-class parents, the lady across the street, the people across were blue-collar. So he was a mechanic. He worked unbelievably hard, and he'd come home and drink, and he was irascible, and his wife was just an incredibly sweet lady, and she worked at some store in the shopping center, and she rode her bicycle. They had one car, and she rode her bicycle to work and rode home. And I somehow figured out that where she was working at the time, that was just I'm sure it was in retrospect because I didn't know it at the time, but I realized, oh my goodness, that lady was working a minimum wage job, and it, you know, which was $1.15 an hour or whatever it was in 1968. And when you go back and look at that, it's like that's 1968. That's massively wealthier than 1950. So the country was incredibly better off by 1968 than it was in 1950. So people were poor as church mice in 1950. And as a result, you better believe that it was sex was very, very dangerous and expensive, and women guarded it carefully. They had to. There was just too much on the line. So that's changed, and with it, everything has changed and will continue to change. So single momhood isn't the horrific poverty threat that it was, you know, 70 years ago. Mike makes other comments about, wouldn't it be true more resources causing better outcomes? No, that's incorrect. So more resources is not causing better outcomes. More resources and intact families are correlated with better outcomes. And that's because the genes are driving it all. So that's a very interesting mistake to make. And it's such a powerful illusion that it will be, you know, it's basically impossible. You can't tell that to a politician. You can't tell that to an educator. You can't tell that to, you know, just about anybody. they can't choke that down. They would have to have an education in behavior genetics to understand this. So, and nobody's going to get it.
Yeah, there's nothing intuitive about it. Yeah. And not from people's own experience either, where it seems like their life is so much better when they have more money. So it's like, oh, well, obviously, the more money you have, the better your life outcomes are going to be, the better schools you're going to get into, the better all the way down.
Yeah, when the truth is that now, another very interesting point made by Robert Plumman. This is a fascinating point. And that is that the outcomes were not as genetically determined in 1950 as they are now. And that is because of deprivation causing, you could have someone who is a genetic star, but there was there was racial, ethnic, financial, religious, familial obstacles put in their way and not enough opportunity, and they couldn't get to the other side of the obstacle and get to where it is that they could thrive. So that, and we all know that that's true. And that's part of human history, and it was certainly part of American history. And however, as the environment becomes more open and more wealthy, and now whether or not if you're a single mom, whether you make $30,000 a year and that's what you can support your child with, or whether you make $60,000, it doesn't really make any difference. The child is okay. There's plenty of food. They're not malnourished. They're not in a dangerous place. And so as a result of that, they can, if they have the chops, they're going to rise and head towards whatever that genetic capacity is. That's what's going to happen. We know this because the correlation coefficients are rising over the decades. The genetics becomes increasingly predictive of outcomes as time passes. This is
because you're effectively controlling for the environment when everybody's like in an equal, you know, essentially an equal opportunity environment above, like there's a certain threshold where it's like, yeah, people aren't living in this grinding poverty where they're truly deprived of basic opportunities. But this is also how you get the paradox in Scandinavia that has vexed many leftist researchers with that you don't have as many women as you might like to see going into science and technology jobs, because the personality expression becomes more elevated in an environment of equal economic opportunity.
Right.
You've controlled for access. And so what you see, the difference in the data becomes driven by personality differences. And that looks like gender differences.
Exactly the same thing true across history when we talk about wealthy people being obese.
Right.
Okay. Because it was only the wealthy people that had access to the rich food. But by 1990, everybody has had access to the rich food of the United States. And so now what you see is it's not your wealth that is predicting whether you're obese, it's your genetics. So the genetics go from not being able to predict obesity in 1920 to, you know, obviously they probably predicted it, you know, 0.3, whereas wealth was a bigger predictor. So environment was a much bigger predictor of obesity in 1920. And then by the year 2000, wealth is not any predictor at all of obesity.
Yeah.
Zero.
Because everyone is royalty.
Everyone is royalty. And so now the genetics wind up being, I think, what is it, 80% of the variance? Yeah.
Yeah, 80.
It's 80% of the variance. So that's extraordinary. And so the same thing is true with intelligence and educational achievement. And the same thing is true, and also... not completely, and not to be unfair or brutal, but a word that we would use is that the environments are functionally equivalent. So I grew up obviously in a functionally equivalent environment to somebody whose parents, you know, John D. Rockefeller's kids. It's like, what's the difference when you go to Harvard? Sorry, Jen, just hit that one again. You got to. And I go to UC San Diego with the middle class kids. What's the difference? Really, it's the same textbooks. It's the my professors were Ivy League people. It's like, hey, it's the same information. So you get functional equivalence. And now at this point in history, the bottom 20% is not there because of obstacles. They are significantly there because of the genetics. And so the not entirely. We don't want to make that case, but it is largely the case. So as a result of that, that's why more resources do not cause better outcomes at this point. That's not going to be how that goes down. So yeah, excellent question, complex question, and the concepts run the gamut from across many interesting domains and important domains of human action.
Mike, thank you very much for the phone call. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
All right. Thank you.
All right, we have our next caller. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Rob. Can you hear me?
Hey, Rob. Yes. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi.
Hey.
All right, Rob, Nate, fire when ready.
Yeah, go ahead.
Nate, I don't know what you're trying to do by putting those two super brains of Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle together on one show, but I mean, just how dumb are you trying to make the rest of us average IQ people feel? I mean,
starting off with some smooth. Good there.
This guy's gotten a lot of dates.
I mean, just two.
All right,
just,
Rob, I mean, just fire two, away.
Just two national treasures we got here, but we're running out of time, so I gotta chill out on the circuit flooding. But I got two quick questions if possible. Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle, I'm trying to understand or how to properly understand the difference between bad habits and bad personality traits in the context of, like you say, that somebody can't, you can't change a personality, right? But so there's bad habits, someone's an alcoholic, they're caught in the pleasure trap, they're doing drugs. Most people agree on what bad habits are, but then you have bad personality traits in the sense that people, they think that there's some subjectivity there in what you think. Different people are going to disagree and agree on what's a bad personality trait. So, for example, let's say you're dating someone, and a few months into dating them, you find out that when you go on a drive on the road with them, so something trivial like this, you drive on the road with them, and they get really upset at they have like road rage, and they're in the passenger seat, and you're the one driving, to the point where it ruins your whole day. Is that a bad habit or is that a bad personality trait? And because you can't change your personality, can they change that? Or another thing, like I don't like cilantro. You know, you've talked about this, Dr. Lyle. Like, I don't like cilantro, no matter how much they pay me. It's genetic. I even did the 23andMe, which says that I have the genes to not like cilantro. So if my partner makes a dish with it, and it hurts her, and she likes it, it's like there's nothing, that's not a – that's more of a genetic thing, but you understand the gist of what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that with the road rage, those are two slightly different things. So the road rage is like an indication. It is a habit, but it's a habit that is emerging from a personality trait. So definitely that, if I don't know how hypothetical this example is or not, but that habit is expressing itself as a function of the cost-benefit analysis of that person relative to the position of power in the relationship with you and the predisposition to sort of have a little bit of instability and disagreeableness that would create a condition of road rage. So definitely if you were to raise the stakes in that particular relationship and say, hey, listen, like this road rage thing of yours is an absolute deal breaker and I am out of this relationship if you continue to express this when we're driving together, like I cannot deal with it. It makes me feel really unsafe and I can't continue to be in a relationship with you. You have the potential in that relationship if that person also has enough conscientiousness and they're sufficiently rewarded in the relationship with you. They can change the CB based on new information that emerges in that relationship to alter that behavior and quote unquote change that habit. So they're not a person who can, there's certainly some people who don't have that conscientiousness. No matter how over-rewarded they would be, they wouldn't be able to control that level of reactivity if they're sufficiently unstable and sufficiently disagreeable. It's just going to happen with them. But most people, if the cost-benefit becomes, you tighten those screws enough, people can adjust their behavior relative to any value proposition in a specific relationship. The cilantro thing, it strikes me as just sort of, I don't know how hypothetical that is, but that really just seems like an educational, hey, I really don't like cilantro, please don't make things with it. And if that continues, that seems like more a sign that that this is not a person who really is very rewarded by that relationship, and that's just kind of more fundamentally shitty than the road rage example. So I would see those as kind of springing from slightly different places, and the cilantro thing is a lot easier to fix because it's not an emergent quality of the personality like the road rage thing is. So that would be my general take on those things. People can absolutely change their behavior in a specific context if the cost benefit is it tilted in a direction that forces it upon them. It doesn't mean that it changes their personality, though.
Yeah, and I would say, Kenny, you're still there? Let me add a few things. First of all, this is what's called getting to know people. So you see things that you don't like that are disturbing, and obviously we're going to give them some feedback about it, and then we're going to see what happens. And so we're going to find out just how modifiable, you know, our feedback, or essentially what that personality characteristic really looks like and how susceptible it is to this kind of CB changes that Jen's talking about. So usually, I mean, when this is sort of this, we have a word for that, red flags. Okay. So that's like, yeah. Uh-oh, that's where that personality is. And you can change somebody's CB by putting a gun to their head, but that doesn't really make it a person that we want to be hanging with. So the other question that we touch something else, this notion of habits. And there's a class of habits that are very interesting and important to understand that there's some wiggling worms in our scheme here that we have to account for. And that's going to be what we call both conditioning processes as well as neuroadaptation. So you can have what you'd call a really bad habit: food, cigarettes, you know, drugs of different kinds, gambling, etc. And one of the problems with some of these things is that they can be tar pits because of neuroadaptation. So you get changes in nerve function that, for example, make healthy food taste bad. It just doesn't taste very good because you're now got dulled senses, or you can't get through the day without, you know, six lines of cocaine because you're going into withdrawal and everything else seems dull and flat. So as a result of that, that isn't a personality problem. The openness may have got the person into it, but supernormal stimuli has a hook in their mouth. Now, so that, call it what you like, you can call it addiction, which gives it a chilling, you know, accurate warning. But what else would you call it other than a bad habit? That's exactly what it is. And so the bad personality, in principle, any personality, no matter how unpleasant, has an ecological niche where it's great.
Right.
Kind of low conscientiousness, disagreeable, is a great hitman. You know what I mean? Quite a good
totally.
Hitman. The what's that?
Yeah, totally. There's no value judgment at any end of the spectrum here. Like, there's always somewhere that it's going to be absolutely the ideal type for a particular job.
That's right. But whereas bad habit, we can see that isn't true. It's a bad habit because it's consistently going to result in bad outcomes. And the one reason why that's going to be true is there's some kind of distorted process in the person's ability to learn from the CB that gongs it over the head with prices. And one of the problems is that we're not designed by nature to, for example, snort cocaine, feel the high, and then connect that to the really bad feeling that we have later. We're not designed to make that connection. You're not designed to make the connection between the high of alcohol and the hangover. And so as a result, obviously you can consciously connect it, but you're not designed to make that connection. So your CB, your ability to run the CB on the next round is not good. And that's why that's the trap of the pleasure trap, is the disturbance, the cheating of the CB leads us inexorably, potentially, into these messes that are very destructive. Those are bad habits. And those can absolutely change. Because if you get out of the environment and you get away from the substance itself, for example, is exacerbating the CB process, but we get far enough away from the substance, then we can reestablish appropriate CB. So a lot of people have, you know, beat alcohol. A lot of people, some people beat heroin. I got a friend of mine that did it. The pretty rough, you know, unbelievable guts, but did it. Like, just flat out beat it. The many people have beaten aspects of the pleasure trap and walked away and gotten distance from them and never gone back. So they had horrendous, you know, behavior patterns that looked disastrous, and that they and then their lives took tremendous changes for the positive. So yeah, bad habits and bad personality are absolutely two different things. Bad personality is something that isn't going to change and that's going to recurrently have a certain behavior pattern under certain conditions. And, you know, i.e., unless we change the CB on those conditions, we're going to see it. So if we get someone who's repetitively road rage, count on it. They're going to be road raging when they're 80, like my dad.
And even if you can get them to stop the road rage, like in the in the specific context of your relationship, it's whack-a-mole with the personality traits that are driving the road rage. So it's like it's important to like look at those kinds of habits as tells of the larger high concept of what personality trait is contributing to it, because it's not just a specific road rage circuit. It's coming from an equilibrium of instability, disagreeableness, low conscientiousness, all the things that are going to pop up in other areas of that person's life when they're under sufficient stress and have the right opportunity. So when you're seeing that early in a relationship, like Dr. Lyle saying, that's a red flag, and it's something that's upsetting you for a reason. So even though you can tighten those screws and change that specific behavior under very specific conditions with enough threat or enough incentive, it's the personality that created it is still there, and it's going to emerge elsewhere.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Fascinating. Rob, thank you very much for the phone call and the wonderful questions, and for being a listener of the show. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you again. Wonderful. Just loved your answers. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Happy Wednesday, Nathan. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.